actually be starting in chapter 8. Sister called me last week and said, "Did you cover chapter 8? And I looked in the Bible and said, "No, I guess I skipped that one." So we'll go back and get it real quick, and then we'll go on the rest of the way. So Luke chapter 8 and verse 39 is the verse there. Here Jesus has just healed a man who had been possessed by demons. And after healing this man, he tells this man in verse 39, "Return to thine own house and show how great things God hath done unto thee." And he went his way and published throughout the whole city how great things Jesus had done unto him. It's just amazing. Return to your house. This man was living out in some tombs, out in the middle of a cemetery, in essence. And yet he had a home that he could have been living in. That's the kind of an impact Satan will have on your life. Satan, through his demons, had possessed this man to the point that this man had given up his home. In one of the other Gospels, it talks about his friends and family. He'd given it all up to go and to live naked in a cemetery and have to be chained to stones. That's the kind of power Satan can have over a person. We need to be aware of that. Satan is not weak in any sense. And so we have to constantly be aware of his danger. Fortunately for us, Satan can't have his demons possess us in the way that this man was possessed. But that doesn't mean we can't fall under his control. There are people who, because of drug addictions or because of other problems that they have in their lives that they can't get over, that they might as well be possessed by a demon, because it controls them just as thoroughly. That's their only purpose in life, is to fulfill that particular lust or desire that they have. And it ruins their lives. But here's this man. But now, after Jesus comes and changes his life, he's able to go back home and to be able to tell what great things God has done for him. We need to all be able to go out around and about to the people that we know, particularly to the people who knew us before we were Christians, and to be able to say to them, "Look at the great things God has done for me. Look how he's changed my life. Look how different I've become because of him." Now certainly, we know that that's not going to save someone. In the denominational world, they call that testifying, giving a testimony. But Jesus tells, go and tell what the Lord's done for you. That's not going to tell them how to be saved, but it might make them want to find out how to be saved. If they see that you used to be this kind of person, and now you're a much better kind of person. What changed your life that much? Maybe it could help me in my life too. People will be interested in finding out about this Jesus that was able to change your life in such a dramatic way. So we need to be willing and ready to go and tell what great things God has done for us. We did cover chapters 9 and 10 last week, so we'll move on to chapter 11 then. Chapter 11 and verse 8. Here Jesus tells a story about a man who comes in the middle of the night to somebody's house, a friend's house, and wants some bread, because he has some visitors that have come to his house. Verse 8, Jesus says, "I say unto you, though he will not rise and give him because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needs." Talking about loaves of bread. Because of the man's boldness, because of his persistence, because of the fact that here he is in the middle of the night banging on the door just to get him to go away, the man's going to give him what he wants. You know, sometimes we underestimate persistence and boldness. Paul asked that the Christians pray that he might preach with boldness, that he might have that kind of persistence in preaching and that kind of power, not to be shy, but to just boldly speak what needed to be said. It's an amazing thing that boldness can do. I've seen people get and do things that you would have never thought they'd been able to do just because they didn't give up. They went about doing it. It's said that the bumblebee, by all laws of science that we know and understand, shouldn't be able to fly. But he does it anyway. We see him every day, just about, especially this time of year, flying around all over the place. He just does it. There are a lot of people who get sucked up in the idea that I can't do this, or I might as well give up. But Jesus here teaches us a lesson. If you want something, you've got to go after it. And of course, his idea here, along those lines of the fact that if we ask, then he goes on to say, ask and it'll be given to you. Sometimes we don't receive the blessings God has to offer us because we don't ask for them. We don't receive the knowledge that God has to offer us because we don't seek it. See, God tells us how to get these things, but they're not just going to be jammed into our head against our will. We've got to want it. We've got to go after it. We've got to do it. Chapter 12. Verses 19 and 20. Probably many of us have heard this parable before. The parable of the rich fool. It actually starts in verse 13. This is the end of it. He thought he was doing so well, he was going to have to tear down his little barns and build big barns to put all of his belongings in because everything was so good. He says in verse 19, I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Verse 20, God has something to say. God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Now God's not teaching here that we shouldn't save up for retirement or save up for the future or anything like that. That's not his point. His point is that in doing so, we better not forget about God. He says, so is he that lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. If we think that we can cheat God out of his share, we're wrong. The only person we're going to cheat out of a share is ourselves. We cheat ourselves out of a share in heaven. Because God is not going to give to those who are unwilling to give. Here this rich man thought he had it all. He thought he had everything he needed. But he forgot the most important thing. He didn't have God. We need never forget that we need God. Chapter 13, verses 8 and 9. A fig tree was planted in this vineyard, and it wasn't giving any fruit. The owner of the vineyard was ready to cut it down. Verse 8 says, and he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it, and if it bear fruit, well, and if not, then after that, thou shalt cut it down. Jesus here lets us know that we better be bearing some fruit. And that fruit may take different forms. Some people, it may be their own spiritual growth one year. Other people, it may be helping someone else to grow that year. Another time, it may be helping someone to come to Christ one year. But there are fruits. We read about the fruits of the Spirit. We need to be developing those fruits in our lives. And as a result of that, we're going to be influencing other people as well. But if we're not bearing fruit, we're going to be cut down. And those bushes, those trees, those plants that are plucked up or cut down, go into the fire. That's all they're good for. We need to be considering always what we can do in our lives to bear fruit for God. Chapter 14, verse 33. This is one of the hardest things I think that Jesus makes. so likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. We've got to forsake everything. We can't put anything ahead of Christ. Anything he asks us to give up, we have to be willing to give it up. That's hard sometimes. And there are many of us who have such trouble with that, that it will keep us from heaven because there's something in our life that's more important to us than following Christ. Jesus says, if you can't forsake all of it, you can't be my disciple. That's a difficult thing, and it's hard for us to fulfill it. We have to work every day to make sure that Jesus is first in our life and that nothing is in the way of following Him. Chapter 15, verse 29. The parable of the prodigal son or the lost son. We see here the response of the older brother. And he answering said to his father, "Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends." He goes on to complain some more about the way the father treated the son who had been lost and had come back. Sometimes that older brother is a lot like us. Or perhaps I should say we're a lot like that older brother. When someone comes back to God after having been away, we're kind of jealous because of the attention, because of the joy over that individual's repentance. And we think, here I am, I've been going along doing what I ought to do for all these many years, and nobody's ever coming up to me and giving me hugs and giving me encouragement like they do this fellow that's been out there in the world for the last year and a half or 3 years or however long. Here he comes back up in here and everybody's giving him a hug and helping him, offering to do anything they can for him, and nobody ever does that for me. It's easy sometimes for us to be bitter. But we've got to realize that God is just. He's not being unfair when he treats those who return with the love and the same love that he treats us. Sometimes, however, I think we should show some appreciation for one another, particularly for those who remain faithful without faltering. We need to let them know how much we appreciate the fact that they're faithful. I appreciate every Sunday night when I come and there are a lot of folks that aren't here. And I appreciate those that I know are going to be here, and that I can count on them being here if there's not some serious reason that they couldn't be. I appreciate that. And we should appreciate the good that we do for one another. But we should also be joyful any time someone comes back that was lost. Jesus in the 15th chapter says on more than one occasion that there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner that repents than over 99 that didn't need to. He lets us know that there's a great thing about a person moving from being in a lost condition to being in a saved condition. That's much more of an accomplishment than for someone who's already in a saved condition to just remain there. It's so much more important in some ways. Chapter 16, verse number 10. Here Jesus says, "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." Now here also he's talking about money and the way we deal with money. But he could be talking about any stewardship that we have. If we think about that, that's true. The person that you could trust to give you back a penny, if you gave them a penny too much change at the store, you could trust that person to bring back a $100 bill too. But the person who would keep the penny, that a good chance they keep the 100. See, the person that's going to be faithful in the little thing, they're still going to be just as faithful, just as trustworthy in the big thing. But the person that you can't trust in something small, and people all the time say, oh, that's just a little thing. I'm trustworthy when it comes to the big thing. No, that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, if you can't trust somebody with the little things, don't you dare give them something important. They're not going to be trustworthy in that area either. How many times have people ruined relationships or even their entire lives as a result of not being trustworthy? And it always starts with the little things. I'll just do this little thing and it'll be okay. Nobody will notice. Nobody will care. And then it's a little bit bigger thing and then a little bit bigger thing. And before long, this is the fellow that embezzled millions of dollars like in the Enron scandal. Or this is the person who's wound up killing somebody. Or this is the person who's wound up neglecting some very important duty that caused harm to others. There's so many cases of that in our world. All because people aren't trustworthy in the little things. Chapter 17. Verse 10. Jesus here in verse 10 points out to us the grace of God. He says, so likewise you, when you have shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. In the verses before this, he said, if the servant does what he's told to do, does he get thanks? Does he get praise for that? No. That's what he was supposed to do. That's what was expected of him. You show up to work on time, does your employer come, oh, I'm so glad you're here on time. No, that's what's expected of you. And so Jesus says it is with us in God's law. Even if we do everything that's commanded of us, we're still unprofitable. It means we aren't making a profit for God. God isn't gaining anything, even if we are doing everything we're supposed to. God's still not gaining a thing. Because the price he paid was so high. He paid the price of his own son. There's nothing that we can possibly do that could ever pay him back for that. No matter what we do in our life, we'll still be unprofitable. We won't be able to make a profit for God. Even all of us put together could never pay him back for the life of his son. We need to understand that. We need to understand that we need to do everything we can because of the great debt that we do owe. But understand as well that we'll never pay it off. There'll never come a day when we can say, God, you and I are even. I'm done. I'm going to retire now. I'm going to quit. It doesn't work that way. We'll never pay him off. Chapter 18, verse 14. Here another parable. Jesus tells a lot of parables, and Luke records many of them. Here the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. They both went up to pray. The Pharisee was so proud of himself, and the publican, or the tax collector, was so humble before God. Verse 14, Jesus says, I tell you, this man, that being the tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other, that's the Pharisee. For everyone that exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted. God doesn't care how important you think you are in your own eyes. It doesn't matter to him. It doesn't matter if you're a movie star, or a star athlete, or the president of the United States, or the emperor of the world. That doesn't make you more important than somebody else in God's eyes. This Pharisee was, we just talked about how even if we do everything we're supposed to, we're not going to pay off the debt we owe God. But that's exactly what this Pharisee was saying. He said, boy, I'm glad I'm not like these other folks. Boy, look what I do for you, God. I do this, and I fast, and I pray, and I tithe, and boy, aren't you glad I'm on your team, God? Boy, where would you be without me? God would be right where he is without you. He's not going anywhere just because you are or aren't on his side. He wants you to be on his side, but not for his good, for your good. And we need to have that humble spirit. The tax collector or publican stood there. He wouldn't even look up. He was so ashamed by the sin in his life, and he said, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." We need to have that kind of an attitude toward God. Instead of being haughty and thinking of ourselves as so good and so holy and so righteous, we need to realize that if God looks at us, he sees one of two things. Either somebody covered in sin, or somebody that was covered in sin that's now covered by the blood of his son. Those are the only two things God's going to see when he looks at a human being. What are those two things? We need to be sure that we have a humble spirit before God. Chapter 19, verse 40. The people were praising Jesus as he came into the city of Jerusalem. Some of the Pharisees said, "Oh, you better stop them from saying that." They thought it was blasphemous. Because the people were saying, "Blessed be the King that comes in the name of the Lord." Verse 40, Jesus answered and said to them, "I tell you that if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out." So there are some truths that just can't be kept quiet. He said, there is no way that the whole world is going to be kept quiet about Christ. We see that when Jesus is crucified, even the Son is ashamed to shed its light on that day. The sun was darkened from noon until 3. The sun was even ashamed to shine on the day when its Creator was crucified on a cross. Jesus lets us know that there is a way we can know there is a God. In Romans it said that the heavens declare His glory. In one of the Psalms rather, it says the heavens declare His glory. It's written all over the world, all over the universe, that there's a God out there. And here He was in the flesh. He let them know, you can't keep it quiet. If you try to shut the people up, the rocks will jump up and start shouting. Now that would have been something to see. I almost wish that they'd have been able to shut the people up just so we could hear about those rocks jumping up to shout out about Jesus. That would have really been something. You know, it's not beyond God's power. Remember back with Balaam and Balaam's donkey, and God made that donkey speak, didn't he? If he could make a donkey speak, he could make a rock speak. He sure could. So, it would have been interesting to see, but it didn't happen quite that way. But it very well could have. Jesus said it would have if they'd have stopped the people from talking. Then chapter 20, verse 18. Jesus talks about himself as the stone that the builders rejected, and he's now become the cornerstone, the head of the corner. It says in verse 18, "Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken. But on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder." Jesus lets us know we've got two choices. Either we can fall on him, and he'll break us. Or we can steadfastly refuse to fall on him, think we're strong enough to stand against him, and he'll fall on us. And if he falls on us, he won't just break us, he'll crush us. That's the fate that awaits all of those that are in rebellion against God. God's going to crush them. Jesus says, if you fall upon that stone, you'll be broken. But if the stone has to fall on you, you'll be crushed to powder. Ground down to powder. Chapter 21 and verse 20. You might mark in the margins here next to verse 20, a couple of cross-references, one to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15, and the other to Mark chapter 13 and verse 14. Both of those two passages, Matthew 14, 15 and Mark 13, 14, say pretty much the same thing. They say, when therefore you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not, then flee to Judea. The reason I put this as a cross-reference is because some people try to somehow equate those two passages with the end of time, with the end of the world. But Luke makes it clear what those two passages were talking about, because talking about the same situation, he says in verse 20, "And when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." And then he goes on to say the same thing that Matthew and Mark said. "Then let them that are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them in the midst depart out of it, and let not them that are in the countries enter in," and so forth. So he lets us know that the event that's being discussed in all three of these passages is not the end of the world, but rather the destruction of Jerusalem. It says, "When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, know that the desolation thereof is nigh." Not the end of the world is nigh, but the desolation of Jerusalem is near. So that was the warning that he's making, and the same warning in Matthew 24:15 and Mark 13:14. The abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel had to do with an idol standing in the temple, in God's holy place, which would also have been in Jerusalem. Chapter 22. Verse 61. Peter has denied Jesus for the third time. The cock has crowed. The rooster crows. Verse 61 says, "And the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, 'Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me three times,'" or thrice. Jesus turned and looked at him. I don't know what kind of look that was. The disappointment, maybe just the foreknowledge. Jesus had said this was going to happen. It wasn't a surprise to him. The disappointment, maybe the hope that Peter would come back and do what was right. But imagine how Peter must have felt. Seeing Jesus turn and look at him just after he had, for the third time, denied he even knew his Lord and Master. It's no wonder that Peter goes out and weeps bitterly. None of the other gospel accounts, they all record that Peter denies him three times, but none of the other accounts record this about Jesus turning and looking at him. That means that Peter was within visual range of Jesus and still denied him three times. It's not as though Jesus was nowhere to be found. It wasn't as though, you know, Jesus, there was nothing there to remind Peter. Jesus was right there, so close that Peter could see him when Jesus turned and looked at him. Jesus could turn and look at him and see him that close. How far could that have been at night? 50 yards, maybe? It couldn't have been far apart. It tells us how easy it is for us as human beings to turn away from Christ. Even when Jesus was right there, Peter turned away. We can do the same thing. We've got to be careful. We've got to try to stay as close to Jesus as we can. Chapter 23, verse 43. Many know of the thief on the cross. The big argument by some that they don't need to be baptized. Jesus said unto him, verse 43, "Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise." People say, "See, he didn't say anything about this fellow being baptized." Well, There are all sorts of reasons for that. First of all, the most obvious to those who understand the scriptures is, before Jesus' death, the new law had not taken effect yet. No one in the Old Testament had to be baptized. Abraham didn't. Noah didn't. None of the people in the Old Testament did. And this man died under the Old Testament law. But also, because of the fact that Jesus was alive and speaking to this individual, Jesus, who was making the new will, the New Testament, had the right to change it and the right to make any provisions he saw necessary up to the point of his death. Just as he could forgive people their sins, as he did in other places, he could forgive this man his sins. This man's fixing to die. He's not going to commit many more sins. So Jesus can say that. More so, we don't know that this man wasn't baptized by the baptism of John. We have no way of knowing whether he was or not. The Bible doesn't say. We do know that he had a very good understanding about the power of Christ, because he said to a man who was about to die, "Lord, when you come in your kingdom, remember me." The apostles were all thinking it's an earthly kingdom, and they thought when Christ was dying, they thought that was the end of it. They went back to fishing. This man, hanging there on the cross with Jesus, says, "When you come in your kingdom, remember me." What faith that took to be able to say that when you're hanging on the cross next to this fellow and you know you're both about to die. Chapter 24, finally. I want to point out two verses in conjunction together, verse 39 and verse 43. Chapter 24, the last chapter of the book. Verse 39 and verse 43. Jesus says to them, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit has not flesh and bones, as you see me have." And then verse 43, they had just given him some food in verse 42. Verse 43 says, "And he took it and did eat before them." This tells us something about the resurrection that Jesus was a part of. It was a bodily resurrection. Now, perhaps his body was different than it had been before, but it was a body that they could touch. They could handle it. He says, "I have flesh and bones." Notice the body wasn't still in the tomb. The body was gone. And he takes food and eats it right in front of them. Ghosts don't eat food. Ghosts don't have flesh and blood or flesh and bones. You can't touch them and hold them and handle them. And yet Jesus, when he was resurrected from the dead, had a body. Now how that body changed once he ascended up to heaven, we don't know. Paul tells us that we don't know what our resurrection body is going to be like, but that we know that when he comes, we shall be like him. We'll have a body like he has. It's going to be some kind of body. It's not going to be the same, because it's not going to be a mortal body. It's going to be an immortal body. But we don't know all about it. But we do know it's going to be some kind of body. If you're here tonight, and you aren't sure of where you will go in that resurrection day, if you don't have the kind of relationship with Christ that gives you confidence, maybe something wrong in your life that you know you need to correct so that you can know you're right with God. If you have a need to respond to the invitation tonight, we ask that you do so as we stand and as we sing. Oh,